And now we hear the dramatic story of the explosive 1894 clash of industry, labor, and government that shook the nation and marked a turning point for America. I had the great pleasure of reading this book just over the weekend, and it is really stunning. It's called The Edge of Anarchy, The Railroad Barons, The Gilded Age, and The Greatest Labor Uprising in America. In it, Jack Kelly offers an account of the event. At the pinnacle of the Gilded Age, a boycott of Pullman sleeping cars by hundreds of thousands of railroad employees brought commerce to a standstill across much of the country. Famine threatened. Riots broke out along the rail line. Soon, the U.S. Army was on the march, and gunfire rang from the streets of major cities. Again, the name of the book is The Edge of Anarchy, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Jack Kelly back to the roundtable. Jack, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
Great to be here, Joe.
Your work is always impressive, and I always am so interested in it. You know, as I said, I read the book. I think I started it maybe Wednesday or Thursday of last week. And as I was reading it, I would be watching TV, and I'd turn off the television, and they'd be talking about a government shutdown, and they'd be talking about IRS agents calling in sick, and air traffic controllers calling in sick, and then I pick up your book and I read about these Pullman workers, who say, yeah, okay, we're enough of this. So what? Now, obviously, your book came long before the news of today, but I'm curious as to what brings you to the subject.
Well, I always look, Joe, for a story from history that has a narrative that's that really is a story. And the key thing to a story, to me, is always the characters. And George Pullman, who was the antagonist, let's say, in this event, is an interesting character in himself. Eugene Debs, who was led the union that was involved in the strike, is really one of the fascinating characters in American history, and not really that well known, but very influential and a very really just a remarkable human being.
So ultimately, it is a clash between these two men.
It's a clash between, let's say, the values that each of those represented. Pullman represented the classic capital, free enterprise, private property. Debs represented the idea of solidarity among people. And he'd founded the American Railway Union, which was this big railroad union, on the basis of solidarity among all the workers, not divided up into different skill sets, but all the workers. And he represented the idea of the common good and just everybody is in it together. So those two values, which were both very fundamental American values, are really what came to the clash of 1894.
So Pullman makes a lot of money out of the idea of, well, you can go on a train, but what if you went on a train and it was comfortable and it was nice and you were treated royally? And that worked.
And his business really took off with the opening in 1869 of the first transcontinental rail line. So suddenly you could go from East Coast to West Coast in a week, but the trains weren't that comfortable. And as you say, he made them comfortable. He made them luxurious. He gave it status. There was the Pullman name was like the name Cadillac. It was real high end, and people were willing to pay for it. In the way that they would pay for an upgrade on the airlines today. And they could stretch out and sleep at night, and they had great service, and there was a lot of status involved in it. So it was extremely lucrative.
There's a lot to the story, but let me just try to sum it up very quickly and so we can get into some of the nitty-gritty. So he creates, there's outside of Chicago, basically puts this town together as a way of there's a lot of urban ills, so he says, okay, we can bring this together and create this model town near the factory outside of Chicago. All's going well, and then an economic depression hits in the early 1890s, and Pullman says, okay, well, I'm going to have to cut your wages because otherwise I can't afford to keep this going, but I'm going to keep charging you the rent that I was charging you before. And that's where the problem started.
And that resulted in some men going to work, working for 2 weeks. They got paid every 2 weeks. And after deducting rent, they would get a check for $3. Now they had to, support their family for 2 more weeks on that amount of money. One guy got a check for 2 cents. He said he didn't even cash it. He had it framed. It was not only the hardship, and men really fainted on the job because they'd go 2 or 3 days without eating, but it was also a symbol of the contempt that these, what was known as the robber barons, had for the working people.
What ultimately led to the shutdown? I mean, that moment where everything's just shut down.
Well, it was a confluence of events, which the Pullman workers went out on strike, shut down the factory. But Pullman still operated these cars. He didn't sell the cars to the railroads, but he operated them as a concession. So he was still making a lot of money on the cars on the railroads. And the Pullman workers were members of the American Railway Union, which this Eugene Debs had started. The union decided to boycott Pullman cars and not include them on trains. The railroads, hoping to break the union, insisted that trains would not go out if they didn't have the Pullman cars on it. That led to a huge shutdown in rail lines all over the country. The country suddenly realized how dependent they were on the railroads, because all commerce, all transportation was over the railroads. And so it created a great deal of hardship in the country. There was a lot of rioting in the cities. Food prices went through the roof, and militias were called out. And it was all hell broke loose, really.
So let us talk and focus for a moment on Eugene Debs. Bernie Sanders called Debs the most effective and popular leader that the American working class has ever had. Is that true?
I think it is true. I think it's very understandable to me, listening to the rhetoric of Sanders and looking at Eugene Debs. And I would skip ahead to after the strike was over. Eugene Debs, because of the government interference in the strike, rather than remaining as a neutral referee, the government got involved and really helped to break the strike. Debs thought that we have to change the government. It isn't enough just to organize among working people. And so he transformed his organization into the Socialist Party of America, and was the first great and probably the greatest of all time socialist, ran for president of the United States 5 times as a socialist, and was more, I would say, he was more of a prophet than a politician. He never really gained a lot of traction for socialism, but he got the ideas across and always had this faith in America and this optimism about how things were going to go.
But he ran for president, what, 5 times?
5 times.
Yeah, and did not great.
He the most he got was about 6%, which for a third-party candidate was pretty good in those days, but was never...
But you think of that, I mean, 5 times, I mean, that is certainly a, was it, did, I mean, we always ask this question even today of you know, is it serious or is it about the issues? He wanted to get the issues.
I think it was to get the message out. I don't think he ever imagined that he would actually get elected, but he wanted to build up the party. He wanted to support local candidates. And it's interesting that, for example, a city like Schenectady had a socialist government in the 1890s.
Right.
Berkeley, California had a socialist government. Milwaukee had a socialist government. So there was some local traction that it got.
So one of the things that surprised me in the book, I guess maybe not surprised, but I thought it was interesting, was that initially he was not pro-strike.
He was very realistic about the possibilities of the strike. During a depression, there were so many unemployed men that it was really... worked against the idea of a strike, because the railroads could go out and hire unemployed railroad men who were desperate for a job. And so he advised against the strike. But once the strike got going, he began to think, I think, almost that this was it, that the socialist apocalypse was coming, and that if he pushed through the strike, maybe things would fundamentally change in the country. Turned out it didn't happen.
And he becomes very supportive of those workers during that time. As you mentioned at the conclusion of your answer 2 questions ago, which was, and then all hell broke loose, How violent did it all get?
Well, it was there was a lot of disturbance, I would say, first in the early days of the strike. There was a lot of rioting. There were so many people who were unemployed that it gave them an opportunity to express their discontent. And thousands of people who were not even railroad workers would go out in the railroad yards and raise havoc, block trains, burned a lot of old freight trains. Then Grover Cleveland, who was the president at the time, sent in the U.S. Army, and that really ratcheted up the violence. There was about three or four dozen people were shot dead, and when the army came in with the bullets and the bayonets, that really spelled the end for the strike.
We hear this today when there's a dispute and the two sides are fighting and when you have the looting and the burning of the rail cars, some were saying that actually the railroad companies were hiring those people to do that.
Yeah.
We hear that argument today.
There was never proven, but some evidence that was the case. A lot of the cars that burned were older cars. The railroad certainly wanted to instigate more disorder because that worked in their favor. For example, they would put attach Pullman cars to trains that normally didn't carry them, just to aggravate the workers and tempt them to unconnect the Pullman cars, and therefore they would then be fired, and it would ratchet up the incident. So that was certainly a possibility.
Eugene Debs, we talk about. We also, of course, talk about George Pullman, and as you say, this is very character-driven. But when it comes to the government, you have, as you mentioned, President Grover Cleveland. You also have the U.S. Attorney General Richard Olney. And so give us a sense of those two men and ultimately how it's the AG who talks to the president and says this is what we need to do.
Well, it's interesting, Joe, you talk about parallels to today. Grover Cleveland was the first Democratic president after the Civil War, but he was very pro-business, and he had been a businessman up from Buffalo. And he put Richard Olney as Attorney General. Richard Olney had been a lawyer for railroads. He was a director of several railroads, and he held on to those positions as Attorney General. He didn't see any conflict of interest there. And he, rather than operate as the chief officer of justice in the country, he went hand in hand with the railroads with the intent of breaking the strike and breaking the union. And he worked very closely with the railroads to bring that about. And I would say, you know, if you're looking for contemporary parallels, there's a man in the government now named Andrew Wheeler, who is a lawyer for coal companies. He was a lobbyist for coal companies, and he is now at the head of the Environmental Protection Agency.
Right.
The name of the new book is The Edge of Anarchy, The Railroad Barons, The Gilded Age, and The Greatest Labor Uprising in America. Jack Kelly is our guest, and the book is published by St. Martin's Press. I'll mention these at the end, but he's going to be at Oblong Books in Rhinebeck talking about and signing the book on the 10th of January. On the 11th, he'll be at Northshire Bookstore in Saratoga, and on the 7th of February, he'll be at the White Hart Inn in Salisbury, Connecticut. Again, I'll talk about those in a moment. Debs went to jail.
One of the weapons that was used against the strike was an injunction. Attorney General Olney got the courts to issue an injunction that made the strike illegal and made everything connected with it illegal. So if you didn't go to work, you were breaking the law. If you talked to your neighbor about the strike, you were breaking the law, and you could be jailed without trial. Eugene Debs and the other union leaders were jailed on the basis of the injunction. It was argued in the Supreme Court. They lost, and Debs went to jail for 6 months on that charge.
What, when we say the edge of anarchy and the greatest labor uprising in America, as you say, to just go ahead a little bit, is it does it have a profound effect on the future of labor disputes in the country?
It had a mixed effect, I would say, Joe, because it gave the government weapons against the labor movement. In the injunction, in particular, made it very easy to break strikes. It set the labor movement back considerably, but it also, the shock of the disturbance during the Pullman strike was a great impetus to the progressive era, which was just around the corner at that time. And there was a lot of legislation. Some of the first legislation benefited railroad workers, gave them the right to unionize, improved safety and on the lines. And there was quite a bit of state legislation about hours of work, working conditions, child labor, things like that, that came about in the progressive era because people were really afraid, particularly the wealthier people in the country were afraid that we were getting close to something very, very serious. And the Pullman strike was probably the closest we came to the type of insurrection that they had nightmares about.
So the strike sort of goes, it ends kind of on a whimper, doesn't it?
Yeah, once Debs was arrested, once the armies came in, and I think a lot of it had to do with the public just was getting afraid that they were seeing things seemed just to be falling apart in the middle of this serious, serious depression. It was the worst depression in American history up until the one that came down later in the 30s. And so they thought that things were getting out of hand. And generally the public, which had started sympathetic to the strike, because a lot of people hated the railroads. The railroads were very arrogant. A lot of them were run by crooks. But as time went on, they just felt this is going too far, and the public turned against the strike.
And unemployment was so high that it wasn't hard for them to replace the workers.
That was another factor that over time they began to import more and more workers, particularly from the East, where the railroads had been hit very hard during the Depression. And these guys from the East were willing to go out to Western lines and take over the jobs of the strikers.
When Debs was in jail, who ultimately was leading the effort for the Pullman workers?
That was really the problem. There was no leadership.
Right.
Debs controlled the strike through telegraphs. We don't think now, you know, the telephone had been invented, but it was not widely used in the 1890s. And he sent out hundreds of telegrams every day because it wasn't like a strike in a factory where everybody was there together. It was spread out over the whole country. So he tried to keep in touch with all the different contingents of the union, local unions around the country through telegrams. And once that was cut off, they didn't know what to do, and they a lot of them just went back to work.
So, it's a little more nuanced than just to say George Pullman won.
It's the paradox of it really was that George Pullman, though he won the strike technically, and his employees had to go back on his terms, he was reviled afterwards. A lot of even his friends thought that if he'd shown a little bit more flexibility, the country could have been saved this huge turmoil. And he died about 3 years after the strike, really an embittered man. Whereas when Eugene Debs, who had lost the strike, came out of jail, 100,000 people showed up in Chicago to welcome him home and cheered for him. And he was really lionized. So it was kind of a paradoxical result.
You, in the final chapter of the book, you talk a little bit about the what happens to the company after that. And that in and of itself is fascinating, of what happens to the Pullman Company.
Well, the company town, or the model town, was a court decided that was not permissible under the company's charter, and that was sold off. But the Pullman Company continued to thrive long after George Pullman's death, and was eventually incorporated into a large conglomerate, but until the railroads really began to decline, the Pullman name and the Pullman cars were continued to be the top of the line in the rail business.
Pullman porters?
Some people get confused about the Pullman porters as another union story, and that was really a story of the 1920s. George Pullman had hired many ex-slaves, freed slaves after the Civil War, to work as porters, who were the men who made these coach cars into beds at night and served. They were servants for the passengers. And he thought on the one hand, he was doing good. He was a Republican. He believed in Lincoln. And he was giving them jobs. And he became the biggest employer of African Americans in the country. On the other hand, it was good business because at first he didn't pay them anything. They had to work for tips. They never got more than just subsistence wages. And they had to put up with a lot of contempt from the passengers. And they struggled. And unfortunately, Eugene Debs wanted to include them in his union, and the members voted not to. It was one of the low points in racial history in America, the 1890s. And so it was only in the 1920s, under A. Philip Randolph, that the porters were able to form their own union and work and struggle and finally got recognition from the company.
So that story doesn't become the sequel to this book.
Well, it's a very interesting story,
good enough in here. Then.
Yeah, the racial angle. You know, you go back in history. It's in American history. It's hard to avoid it turning up somewhere.
Absolutely. The name of the book, and it's just such a fascinating read. It's The Edge of Anarchy, The Railroad Barons, The Gilded Age, and The Greatest Labor Uprising in America. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. Jack Kelly is the author. He's going to be at Oblong Books and Music in Rhinebeck on the 10th of January, talking about and signing the book. On the 11th of January, he'll be at Northshire Bookstore in Saratoga Springs, New York. And on February 7th, he'll be at the White Hart Inn, talking about the book and signing it. And they're in Salisbury, Connecticut. And all three of those events, you can find out information on our website, which is wamc.org/roundtable. And we'll also have a link to this conversation as well. It's always a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much, and thanks for such a great read.
Well, you're welcome, Joe, and it's always a pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much. Jack Kelly's new book is The Edge of Anarchy, The Railroad Barons, The Gilded Age, and The Greatest Labor Uprising in America. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.